The next case we have is Randolph versus HV and United States. As you can see, we have a full well. The order today will be the initial argument by appellant Randolph, followed by an argument by the appellee HV, followed by argument by the respondent United States, and finally, we will have rebuttal from appellant Randolph. Are counsel ready? Okay. We'll have the initial argument by the appellate, Randolph.
Chief Judge Urban and judges of the court, may it please the court. Chief Judge, I respectfully request to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Granted.
I am Lieutenant Jason Roberts of the United States Coast Guard, and I represent the appellant, Damage Controlman Second Class, Thomas Randolph. The decision of the Coast Guard Court of Criminal Appeals was inconsistent with this court's jurisprudence when it expanded the scope of the Military Rule of Evidence 513 privilege to include a diagnosis from a psychotherapist as a protected confidential communication. And this court has jurisdiction under Article 67A of the Uniform Code of Military Justice to hear Petty Officer Randolph's writ appeal petition because the Coast Guard Court of Criminal Appeals decision on HV's writ was a final action in a case. Regarding the jurisdiction of this court, the ruling in EV, the United States and Martinez, does not limit this court's power to hear writ appeal petitions from the accused on a writ granted to a victim under Article 6B. Article 6B is silent regarding this court's power to hear writ appeal petitions from both a victim and an accused.
It was silent with regard to whether we could hear an appeal from a mandamus, too. And we took that silence to say, nuh-uh.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so why shouldn't we take that silence to say the same thing? Stay out of it, Gav.
Because, Your Honor, under Article 6B, while the statute is silent, Article 67 does speak to the accused's ability to petition this court in a case when the accused...
Are you saying it's simply not a 6B case?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, well then, because 6B is certainly hanging like a brooding omnipresence in the sky here. We said no jurisdiction under 6B, and tell me how that works.
Well, Your Honor, I should clarify. It's not a 6B case before this court. It's a Article 67.
But that's what you're complaining about, right? Is a ruling on 6B.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
That's what the CCA decided.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that's what you don't like.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So how is it not a 6B case?
It is a 6B case, is the way the Court of Criminal Appeals decided the case. But if we can't
review their decision in the opposite direction, why would we want to decide it or be able to decide it when it comes out the other way? I mean, you can't have it both ways.
Because Article 67A, Your Honor, allows this court to hear petitions from the accused. There's no other statutory grant to a victim to bring a petition before this court, but Article 67A speaks...
to findings and sentences approved by the convening authority, right, under 67. That's not what we have here.
No, ma'am, I disagree. This court can act on interlocutory matters where a court of criminal appeals has made a final action in a case, as this court has held going back to 1981 in Redding, and then in 1985 in Tucker, then again in 1996 in Curtin, up to 2008 in Lopez de Victoria, and again in 2013 in LRM v. Kastenberg.
We've done a lot of things over the years.
That's correct, sir. That's correct, Your Honor. Since the Court of Criminal Appeals decision is a final action in the same way the service court's rulings were final actions in Lopez de Victoria and LRM, then this court has jurisdiction under Article 67A over this case and may consider DC-2 Randolph's writ appeal petition. Turning to the MRE 513 issue, the language of Rule 513 is clear and straightforward. If a communication between a patient and a psychotherapist was made for the purpose of facilitating a diagnosis or a treatment of the patient's mental health or emotional condition, then the patient has a privilege to refuse to disclose and to prevent others from disclosing that communication. The rule does not say that a diagnosis or treatment plan or even a communication of a diagnosis or treatment plan is privileged. And this court has recognized the principle that privileges should be narrowly construed because they run contrary to a court's truth-seeking function. And while this court has not interpreted the scope of Rule 513, the analysis of this court in United States versus Custis construing privileges in the rules is helpful here. First, consider the plain language of the rule. Rule 513 qualifies the type of confidential communications that are protected, those whose purpose is to facilitate a diagnosis or treatment. Second, enforce the rule according to its terms unless doing so would produce an absurd result. And as written, it would not be absurd to protect only those communications made for the purpose of diagnosis and treatment. A diagnosis that is relevant to a witness or an accuser's ability to perceive, process, understand, and rationalize interpersonal behavior is of supreme importance in a criminal trial. And the rules for courts martial are designed for criminal trials. And the privileges enshrined in our rules, when applicable, must give way to an accused's constitutional rights, both to confront the witnesses against him with relevant evidence and his right to a fair trial.
But what do you do with the argument that the diagnosis will reveal most, if not all, of the confidential communications? And if that is, in fact, the case, then the rule is meaningless.
Chief Judge, I don't believe the diagnosis actually would reveal communications. The substance of those communications would remain protected. The diagnosis would simply be the mental health condition of the witness, the patient, if you will, without getting into what the patient actually told the mental health provider.
But the diagnosis has to be based on something, and with this, that type of a interaction between the physician and the patient, the only thing that the physician has, the psychoanalyst has, is what's being told. That's the sole source.
You're right, Your Honor, that more than likely is the sole source. However, I refer back to the rules for construing the privileges, and you have to apply the plain language of the rule as it's written.
Unless it wouldn't produce, I think Judge Erdman's suggesting that it would produce an absurd result because it would gut the privilege.
Your Honor, I would disagree. I don't believe it would gut the privilege. Again, the communications that were made to facilitate the diagnosis or treatment would not be subject to revelation, only the diagnosis. And as the court explained in Custis, it would be error for the Court of Criminal Appeals to expand the scope of the privilege because it does not have the power to do so. The president is the one who promulgated the rule. The president is free to create a broader privilege to encompass all confidential communications, much like the privilege for confidential communications between spouses. And the president did not do so. As this court said in Custis, it is for the policy-making branches of government to weigh the utility of the privileges against the truth-seeking function of this court-martial and, if appropriate, make adjustments.
When you're talking about the diagnosis here, are you talking about, for instance, just a term that the psychoanalyst would say, my findings are that the patient is psychotic?
Yes, Chief Judge.
That's it?
That's it. All we're discussing is the diagnosis, not the underlying communications that were made to make the diagnosis.
The result.
Exactly. Pending no additional questions, I have nothing further to present this court.
Any further questions? Thank you. You'll have time on rebuttal. Okay, who's next here in our... The appellee, HV.
Good morning, Chief Judge Erdman and members of the court. May it please the court, my name is Lieutenant Commander Kismet Wunder, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Deanna Daly of the United States Air Force, we represent AMT-2-HV, the victim and appellee in this case. Because of the importance of the psychotherapist-patient privilege, we respectfully request this court recognize the need to protect privileged communications and uphold the decision of the Coast Guard Court of Criminal Appeals.
How is the diagnosis of communication?
It is a communication because it is inextricably linked to the language that is used by, the words used by the patient in order for the psychotherapist to come to a diagnosis. So, for example, if you have a medical doctor can look at a cut or a broken bone and use medical treatment or medical diagnostic tools, x-rays and such, in order to examine the patient, come up with a treatment plan, and then actually fix that patient. But unlike in the area of psychotherapy, a patient can only be diagnosed if that patient freely communicates with the psychotherapist. And so the
that's because we want them to be able to say whatever they're going to say without the specifics that they're saying being revealed, right?
Yes, Your Honor, absolutely.
Not some concern about, and then the doctor's going to say you're psychotic.
Well, Your Honor, a patient engaging in psychotherapy would potentially be concerned that they would be labeled psychotic if the diagnosis and the treatment plan and the medications they were prescribed were provided to people outside of that inner circle, that being the patient and the psychotherapist. And so that's the reason why the communication is inextricably linked to the diagnosis and the treatment.
But it doesn't say that.
No, it does not.
One would presume that some care was taken with the drafting of this thing all the way up to the president because it deals with an important matter. It establishes a privilege which is to be narrowly construed. And it doesn't say that. You know, you can say, well, it's inextricably linked. Well, if it's inextricably linked, they could have put it in there, and they didn't.
Yes, Your Honor, but as you pointed out when appellant was arguing, to come up with a rule that says the diagnosis and the treatment of the medications, applying that plain rule or plain language, would result in an absurd result of the analysis.
I didn't say that. I said that I suggested that might be an interpretation of what the chief judge
said. Why would that be an absurd result if the diagnosis is just a term? It has nothing about what is communicated, the substance of the communication. It's just a label. And I'm not sure that the rule goes so far as to prevent that.
Your Honor, if I could provide the court an analogy to the attorney-client privilege, if an attorney was called to the stand and said, I would like you to give your diagnosis, your opinion as to whether your client is guilty and not guilty, not revealing any of the communications you received from your client, but tell me, is he guilty or not guilty of the charges pending? Again, that same result applied in...
Well, the attorney's going to say he's not guilty, isn't he?
Well, he may, but if he's under oath, maybe he's got to say that he is guilty.
But his duty
I'm
is to say...
I'm pretty sure that there's bar rules that preclude him from answering that question.
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor, but the analogy still stands in that if you change the context over to the attorney-client privilege, it seems like an absurd result that you would require an attorney to testify regarding their diagnosis of their client's guilt or not.
Well, let's have it be a different thing. You know, it's not a criminal matter, right? Did you form an S corporation, right, or a regular corporation? You think that he couldn't answer that question?
Well, Your Honor, that would the attorney would have filed.
What type of corporation, you know, did you create?
Well, that record would have been filed with the state agency that governs forming of corporations, and so that disclosure would be necessarily already revealed. What we're talking about here is confidential communications, and
that's what we're talking about is confidential communications, and I think everybody's in agreement that that's what the rule says. The question before us is whether or not a consequence of those confidential communications, which is the diagnosis, which, according to the rule, the confidential communications facilitate the diagnosis, but the rule doesn't say confidential communications include the diagnosis.
Your Honor, well, when you look at MRE 513 Bravo 5 and you look at the evidence, where you would go and find the communications.
But what does that provision mean anywhere? It's not used anywhere else in the rule. Evidence of a patient's record or communications, in quote. And usually that would then be found somewhere else, and it's not.
Your Honor, that's found in the manner in which you go and you find the records that a party would submit as part of the records that would be considered by the court in determining whether or not there was privileged communications.
So that just defines the scope of the communications.
Well, it tells you where you would find the communications because you...
But it's communications for the purpose of treatment or diagnosis, right? It doesn't say, and also the treatment and diagnosis.
No, but when you look at Bravo 5, it says that you find these records in records that pertain to those communications.
Yeah, but that's a definition. That's not a substantive statement of the privilege.
Your Honor, but you can't, if you're trying to administer this rule and you say, well, you can't look at the definitions as to how I'm going to administer this rule, then it's impossible to effectively determine what is the scope, and that's what we're talking about, the scope of the privilege in this case. And when you try and find, when you look at the words pertaining to, that term is...
Pertaining to communications, I mean, to me that would be the doctor's notes, you know, or the assistant's notes that they put in the file.
Yes, Your Honor, it absolutely would be, though, but...
And then this person said X, and then they said Y, and yada, yada, yada. I mean, I think we all agree that can't be disclosed.
Yes, Your Honor, but the issue is that the word pertaining to is not clear as to... It's open to interpretation as to what pertaining to really gives the scope of the rule.
What's your view on the government's, the appellant's argument that we have jurisdiction to even entertain this case?
Your Honor, regarding jurisdiction, the appellee agrees with the appellant that this court may take jurisdiction of this case under Article 67 of the UCMJ.
Well, your client got a mandamus out of the CCA.
Yes, Your Honor.
Which we have held to be unreviewable. By us.
Yes, Your Honor.
If you were denied mandamus.
Yeah.
If you were denied mandamus and you wanted to come up here and ask us to review it, we've said we can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you think that it's reasonable for them to be able to ask us to review something if it cuts the other way?
Your Honor, I think that different...
Is it because you want us to answer the question?
No, Your Honor. If there was a good faith basis under the law and existing rules to say that this court is not allowed to have jurisdiction, my client would, and I would be arguing that this court should not have jurisdiction. But the reality is that different rules can coexist at the same time and not give equal rules or different abilities to access those different rules. So if this was strictly a 6B, the court has already said that there is no jurisdiction of this court, at least for a victim, to argue in front of this court. But as the appellant noted to this court, we're here under Article 67 of the UCMJ, and that gives...
Well, they've said that they're here under Article 67.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right? I mean, that's what they've said.
Yes, and that's what they filed with this court, absolutely.
Does that make it so? I mean, do you understand my question? The fact I could say that something is a cow, and that doesn't make it a cow...
Yes, Your Honor. However, if you look at Article 60, regardless of what they have said, if you just look at Article 67 of the UCMJ,
What is the finding and sentence that we're reviewing?
It is not a finding and sentence you're reviewing. You're reviewing a final action by a court of criminal appeals that may affect the sentencing or the outcome of the case. And under 67, this court does have jurisdiction to examine matters filed by the accused under those circumstances.
Counsel, it sounds like you would not, you would agree that there's nothing remarkable about striking a distinction between a party to the proceedings and a non-party. In other words, the victim witness might be a non-party, and it might make some sense for the law to apply different to that person than to the accused, who has, at least as far as I know, in a criminal proceeding, the most at stake. Would you agree with that statement?
Your Honor, I don't know if I would say it makes sense to limit a victim, but I would say that the state of the law as it currently exists, that would be an accurate statement. Turning back to the substance of MRE 513, if you look at why we have MRE 513, you have to go to the United States Supreme Court and its decision in Jaffe v. Redmond. And when you look at why the underpinnings of that opinion by the Supreme Court looked at both the public and the private good of having a robust psychotherapist-patient privilege. In determining the need for the psychotherapist-patient privilege, the Supreme Court examined these two different areas. And it stated, for the private good, effective psychotherapy depends on an atmosphere of confidence and trust in which the patient is willing to make frank and complete disclosures of facts, emotions, memories, and fears. The court went on to say, the mere possibility of disclosure may impede the development of the confidential relationship necessary for successful treatment. In examining the public good of the privilege, the court found that the mental health of our citizenry is a public good of transcendent importance. With that perspective, the Supreme Court contrasted the privilege with the evidentiary benefit of allowing a party to access this information and found only a modest benefit.
Now, is there a difference between the common law privilege adopted by the Supreme Court and the regulatory privilege adopted by the President?
Absolutely, yes, Your Honor. The regulatory provisions of MRE 513 were specifically enacted to account for the unique nature of military life.
So I guess my point is that we're not following exactly Jaffe.
No, Your Honor, and I'm not. Please don't take my argument as to say that this court is bound by the opinion in Jaffe. I'm merely pointing out to the court that when it looks at why is this rule so important, you have to look at both that public and that private nature of the rule. And when you have something that the Supreme Court says is of transcendent importance, it's important to have that perspective when we determine how this rule should be applied.
And that's despite the plain language of the rule, which seems to cut against your argument.
Well, Your Honor, the plain language of the rule, when you look at how confidential communications that it has, those words are plain on their face, but in application, they are subject to interpretation. And I apologize, these cases were not provided in my brief, but in response to the government's briefing in this case, I think it's worthwhile to point out two cases that this court has previously ruled on, and those are U.S. v. Markham and U.S. v. Pinson. And U.S. v. Markham is found at 60 MJ198, and U.S. v. Pinson is 56 MJ489. This court in Markham stated that a lawyer shall not reveal information relating to the representation of a client, and in Pinson, this court said any exception to the right of confidential communications must ensure there is no chilling effect on the defendants freely speaking with their lawyer. So when you look at those two statements by this court and you look at confidential communications, this court has already said in the arena of attorney-client privilege that you need to have an expansive view of what confidential communications is because of the importance of the attorney-client privilege and what it means in our system of justice. Well, that same tenet applies when you look at the psychotherapist-patient privilege. You can't have confidential communications that are limited in a way that is going to chill a patient's willingness to engage in effective psychotherapy, especially in cases where the likelihood of litigation is high. And on top of that, if there is such a rule that limits confidential communications, that evidence is probably never going to exist because a patient is going to resist engaging in effective psychotherapy because they know that information that they provide, if that's going to lead to a diagnosis that is embarrassing to them, they're not going to engage in that type of behavior because they don't want to be subject to ridicule, especially by the people in these cases that attack them.
Okay. We're in a sense, not reviewing directly the CCA's grant of mandamus, although we are. How do you answer the contention that in equity, you don't get a prerogative writ including mandamus, unless your right is indisputable. And if nothing else, the split in the courts clearly indicates that there's a split of opinion on this, and that therefore, how can her right to the writ be indisputable?
Your Honor, in this case, the Court of Appeals, for the Coast Guard Court of Appeals, have already said that this is that my client has met her burden to be granted the writ of mandamus.
Well, I know that, or they wouldn't have done it. But yes, I'm asking you.
Yes, Your Honor. So this is a matter of first impression before the court, and because there is a split of different other
courts, leaving aside for a moment the premise that if the language is plain, we don't even get there.
Yes, Your Honor.
But assuming we get there.
Yes, Your Honor. So if you look at other cases that have interpreted the this question, most of the cases that have found that a diagnosis or treatment is not privileged, they were looking at cases involving matters where the party seeking to protect the records had introduced that issue into the litigation, or in other cases there was specific to whether or not that privileged communications included diagnosis or treatment, the law in that particular jurisdiction required an affirmative statement by the patient saying why that particular piece of information had confidential communications in it. So, for example, the patient would have to say, in this particular case, my diagnosis contains confidential communications for X reasons. And so when you look at the other body of law, it is clear that a psychotherapist diagnosis and treatment of medications that are confidential communications, and the cases that I cited to in my brief set that out. And as they said, that if these are not, if this type of information is not protected, as you said, it would gut the privilege.
Would you agree, though, that there is a split of interpretation in the federal sector when they look at these cases?
I would agree, yes, Your Honor. There is not a consistent line of cases throughout all federal courts on this particular issue.
How can that then be an indisputable basis for a writ?
Because, as I pointed out, Your Honor, that when you look at the cases most aligned with my client's factual situation, that is... that creates that indisputable right for her to receive the writ. Okay. Subject to your questions, I thank you for your time this morning.
Further questions? Thank you, counsel. Well, I lost my cheat sheet, so whoever's next...
The U.S.
government, okay.
Good morning, Chief Judge and judges of the court. I'm Lieutenant Teresa Oli, and along with Mr. Stephen McCleary, I represent the United States. Under Article 67A3, this court has jurisdiction over this matter because it is a case. As to MRA 513, resort to precedent or other case law.
How is it a case? That's what is confusing me. Like, this is an interlocutory appeal, right? The case is still in existence. This is an interlocutory issue that was raised before the CCA, right, by the government, right, under Article 62. It was raised by you guys under Article 62.
Under Article 67.
But I don't understand how this is here.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're saying it's a case, but it's not a case. It's a discrete issue involved in a case that's interlocutory, that the accused may or may not get convicted. If he is convicted, we review it in the ordinary course.
Yes, Your Honor. This court has found that Article 67 provides for jurisdiction over cases that are reviewed by the CCA, whether the CCA has heard an appeal under Article 62, as the court mentioned, or decided a writ petition under the All Writs Act, whether by certification or petition.
But the problem is that this is under Article 6B. It was under, at the CCA, it was an Article 6B issue, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So that's what we would be reviewing.
Under Article 6B, the CCA heard the case and granted the relief requested, which was mandamus. Under United States versus Curtin, this court held that final decisions by a court of criminal appeals on petitions for extraordinary relief account as cases for the purpose of jurisdiction under Article 67.
What about 6B? Do you see what I'm saying? I mean, we're effectively doing what we said we can't do. And you can call it anything you want, but that's what we'd be doing.
Your Honor.
Explain to me how that isn't what you're asking, what we're being asked to do.
6B provides a vehicle for the victim to go to the Court of Criminal Appeals, and it also prescribes the specified form of relief that that victim may request, and that is mandamus. That is not a new remedy, so it's a little bit unlike Article 62, which created an independent statutory basis for jurisdiction.
Counsel, I can't hear you. Could you speak up, please?
Yes, Your Honor. I apologize.
Thank you.
It's a little bit unlike Article 62, which created a new statutory form for interlocutory appeals for the government. And in Lopez de Victoria, this court found that an appeal by the government under Article 62 could be appealed by the accused by invoking Article 67A3. This court found jurisdiction, even though the posture is a little bit similar, even though, unlike 6B, Article 62 prescribes its own form of interlocutory appeal. It's also a situation where Article 62 is limited only to the government. The accused, for example, could not appeal a case, make an interlocutory appeal under Article 62.
I understand all of that, but what I don't understand is how this isn't a 6B case, which we said we can't review.
Your Honor, the case came to the CCA under 6B, but the relief provided mandamus does fall under the definition of a case under United States v. Curtis. The fact that the vehicle to bring it to the CCA was under Article 6B, which simply states that the victim may go to the CCA under this statute, and the fact that the CCA apparently used the statute as the statutory basis for granting relief mandamus, as is required by the All Writs Act, that doesn't change the form of relief mandamus, which this court has found is a case because it is a final action on a petition for extraordinary relief.
Well, as somebody who wrote Lopez, I'm not sure Lopez was 62 case. This is something else. This is 6B, and we just said we don't have jurisdiction over 6B. I find it a little troubling as the author of Lopez that now we're trying to shoehorn our way back into 6B via Lopez. Tell me how that's not a problem.
We all understand that everyone's saying, oh, this is an Article 67 case, right? But we just decided not very long ago, right, that if the case had come out the other way, that we wouldn't hear it, that we couldn't hear it, that Congress didn't intend us to get involved in 6B issues, that they intended it to stop at the CCA, right?
Yes, Your Honor. We would point to two separate grounds for distinction. First, we are beginning with statutory interpretation. And in Article 6B, it does not discuss the accused at all. It does speak to the victim, and as this court decided in EV, because it says victim and because it only says the Court of Criminal Appeals, that would preclude review by this court of the victim's petition. But it does not mention the accused. It also doesn't mention Article 67 or attempt to constrain it, nor did Congress contemporaneously make any changes to Article 67 to provide any constraints or conversely, an avenue for the victim.
If you look at the plain language of Article 67, this isn't a case, okay? And we may have construed it differently, but Victoria de Lopez has nothing to do with 67, really. It has to do with 62.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. What is helpful in Lopez de Victoria is that this court was not, this court rejected the notion that Article 67 and its requirements for findings of sentence would constrain jurisdiction in this case. And it adopted the discussion of this court in United States versus Leak, where this court refused to interpret the jurisdiction of Article 67 as being constrained by...
Well, and I think that part of Victoria de Lopez, and I obviously dissented from that case, but I think that part of it was a parity issue, right, which is that if the government got to complain to the CCA and the CCA ruled in their favor, that we would let the accused then complain to us, right? So everyone was on the same footing, right? That's not what would be happening here, right? If the accused if it had come out the other way and the victim had lost at the CCA, right, they could not come up here, right?
It would
be dead.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Right? So how is it parity to say that the accused can come up here to appeal a ruling on the 6B issue?
The accused is a party in the case while the victim, Your Honor, is not. So the posture is a little bit different from Lopez de Victoria where there was simply...
But it's an interlocutory appeal, not of the entire case, of a discrete issue decided under 6B.
Yes, Your Honor. The jurisdiction for deciding the case, granting the mandamus, was derived from Article 6B, but the review still lies with Article 67A3 because this is a case that was reviewed by the CCA as announced by United States versus Curtin. That counts as a case, and the court has been operating under that precedent for quite some time now, some recent examples being, of course, LRM and Howell, this court's recent decision in Howell. In addition, this court should adhere to that precedent with respect to this case. In United States versus Quick, this court announced that it should adhere to its previous interpretations of plain language to determine whether this is a case. Stare decisis doctrine, as was set out by this court in Quick, is most compelling when undertaking statutory construction, which is exactly what we're doing here. An adherence to precedent promotes even-handed, predictable, and consistent development of legal principles, fosters reliance on judicial decisions, and contributes to the actual and perceived integrity of the judicial
system. Stare decisis, our most recent decision on 6B, is that we don't have jurisdiction to decide those issues.
Your Honor, yes. Under Evie versus Martinez, this court did not have jurisdiction to decide this issue if it arrived at this court via the victim invoking Article 60. The distinctions between this case is in this case, it's the appellant that comes to this court, not the victim. In this case, the appellant has invoked Article 67A3, which is existing jurisdiction that specifically provides for review of a case reviewed by the CCA, and this court has previously stated that such matters can be cases.
Counsel, I understand how you're going out into the precedent that we've had and so forth, but how do you deal with the following statement? Quote, we are a court of limited jurisdiction and must exercise our jurisdiction in strict compliance with authorizing statutes. And you look at the plain language of the statute, as Judge Ryan has repeatedly stressed here, how within those statutes, not based on precedent, where are we finding our jurisdiction? We're talking about 6B, and you're saying it's not there. There's no authorization there. You're then looking at 67A3, and you're saying this is a case. But in fact, as Judge Ryan is saying, it's not a case. It is a part of a case. So where in the language of the authorizing statute are we finding jurisdiction here?
Your Honor, in order to address that question, to go back to what exactly is a case, this court would have to overrule its previous holdings on what a case constitutes.
Counsel, the problem is that this, it's not even not the whole case. It's not even like the whole, it's not even like a huge case. It's not even a case dispositive issue. I mean, do you really think that we should be looking at every interlocutory ruling that's looked at by the CCA? No matter how inconsequential it ultimately may be? I mean, the accused seek extraordinary relief based on issues, not under Article 67, but they ask for extraordinary relief, right? And we routinely say no, you know, without prejudice, right, to review in the ordinary course of appellate review, meaning if they get convicted, right, and if it ultimately matters, then we'll look at it. Right. Even if this wasn't 6B, why should this be any different?
Yes, Your Honor, under Article 67A3, I think the only reading is that this is, in fact,
a case. Why do these things almost always come up here at writs for extraordinary relief?
In general, the president,
which by saying it's a writ, doesn't that mean it's not a case? I mean, it's a motion for extraordinary relief. It's not the case.
Yes, Your Honor. In United States versus Curtis, this court actually stated that it was a case. And it has also come up in, for example, in United States versus Wooderick. And Wooderick was a case that had to do with whether outtakes of videos could be subpoenaed, and the military judge had quashed the subpoena without looking at the matters at issue. The government had appealed in that case under Article 62, and the court found that the ruling quashing the subpoena was appealable under Article 62. And in that case, Wuderich had filed for review both under Article 67A3, and he'd filed also a petition for a writ, and this court found jurisdiction under 67A3 and found moot the petition for extraordinary relief.
With the precedent you're citing, weren't they motivated by policy concerns and legislative history? Here, there's no legislative history that would indicate that Congress expected or wanted us to exercise jurisdiction. There's no concern about improper dismissal of cases, which would be a war stopper. We can address uniformity of these through direct appeal. So why should we be looking at the precedent in this particular case if the motivating force behind those precedents don't really apply here? And we're supposed to, as a court of limited jurisdiction, supposed to be looking at authorizing statutes.
Your Honor, I would answer that question by going back to the court's precedent and the desirability of not disturbing that. Certainly, this court could answer this question by revisiting the definition of case. Case is the word used by the statute, Article 67A3, where jurisdiction is invoked here.
So you don't see any distinctions that can be drawn behind the motivating force of this court in finding jurisdiction for what might be a motivating force for finding jurisdiction in this case.
And 6B. I mean, that really, this is 6B being shoehorned in under the guise of Article 67.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why do we even have to get into any of that? I mean, I think my views on the matter are pretty well known, but why do we have to get into that? We can simply say it's 6B. And you can't dress it up in 67 clothes and march it in here and have us call it something else.
To answer that question, Your Honor, I would go back to the specific form of relief that is prescribed by 6B, which is not a new form of relief. It is mandamus. 6B generates a statutory authority for the victim to tie their petition for a writ to, but it's not something new. It's still mandamus, and that is why it should be interpreted consistent with this court's precedent that such matters that can be cases. And there
Counsel, go ahead.
Is it the government's position that we can't not find jurisdiction here without doing violence to our precedents on this, particularly Lopez and, I suppose, LRM?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
That was our position.
You know, the fact that this is really a 6B case doesn't matter. The only way we can, if we don't find jurisdiction here, we have to overrule Lopez. Is that the government's position?
Yes, Your Honor. If this court found that there is no jurisdiction, it would have to revisit the definition of cases and precedent.
Well, I'm not talking about the definition of case. I'm talking about specific precedents. That's the government's position.
Yes, Your Honor. In Lopez, Your Honor?
No, because you've lost below. All right, so obviously you want us to decide this case, hoping that it will come out your way. Right.
This is also an important question to be issued not only for Article 67A2, but because it touches on Article 67A3, because it also touches on Article 67A2 and the TJAG's ability to certify. And the United States is also concerned that if this court were to find that there is no jurisdiction due to the language in 6B, for example, or due to the definition of a case, that would also have consequences on TJAG's ability to certify future cases.
Well, Counsel, in the time that's remaining, let's turn to the government's position on the privilege itself.
Yes, Your Honor. The government's position is that the military judge correctly decided the scope of the privilege in MRE 513 by looking at the plain language of the rule. In interpreting military rules of evidence, the three things that should be followed are the principles of statutory construction as set out in Custis, MRE 101, which prescribes the methodology by which federal cases can be considered, and the fact that military privilege is set out in rules, and it's normally for the policymaking branches of government to really conduct the weighing of the utility of privileges against the need for truth and to conduct the criminal proceeding. The military judge properly applied the plain language of MRE 513. The privilege is contained in MRE 513 alpha, and it doesn't create a blanket privilege for every piece of information contained in a psychotherapist's record. The privilege is for confidential communications made between the patient and the psychotherapist, if made for the purpose of facilitating diagnosis and treatment. For the purpose of simply defines the scope, as has been pointed out, it doesn't state that it is inclusive. 513B5 simply explains where confidential communications may be found. It doesn't serve to expand the privilege to records, and neither does 513E, which simply added a process for reviewing a place records where such privileged communications could be found.
Counsel, isn't that a grudging view of the privilege that is supposed to encourage sexual assault victims to come forward for treatment and what have you?
It could be, Your Honor. However, in the almost 16 years since this privilege has been in existence, this court has not had occasion to define the scope of communications, leading to a conclusion that perhaps it's not having a chilling effect that required this court to either address it or the president to make a change, which he could still do, expanding that privilege to include records altogether. Because the president has prescribed this rule, we're bound by the rule's plain language, and we're bound by the principle that it is for the policymaking branches of government.
Right, but isn't this particular argument, isn't this new to the court? Isn't it new to our system? In other words, the definition of what should be disclosed, communications, records, treatment, what have you, isn't that new? Even though the rule has been around, isn't this particular issue new to the court?
Yes, Your Honor. One could view the addition of 513E in 2015 as somehow adding to the rule or bringing this concept of records possibly being communications. But the key is that the repository for the privilege within the rule, 513A, was not changed, Your Honor. That remained the same, and that is what defines the scope of the privilege, and this court has not found a need to address the scope of this specific privilege, nor has the president found a need to amend it due to policy considerations since it was implemented.
If we find no jurisdiction here, is it not still open to the appellant, should he be convicted, to bring us this question in the normal course of appellate review?
It could be, Your Honor. However, the appellant would be in the unusual position of having the Court of Criminal Appeals reviewing itself because the question, the military judge, as the appellant has stated, answered the question at issue correctly. It's the CCA.
Well, then they can just treat it as res judicata, but we can't.
It would certainly complicate appellate review because of the requirement for the court to review itself.
But how would that complicate our appellate review?
It would not, Your Honor. Once it reached this court could still review this matter, and certainly that's a consideration this court can take in deciding whether the appellant has shown good cause to have his petition reviewed. If the court has no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you. Rebuttal? Okay, thank you. The court thanks counsel for all the parties. The court will be in recess until further order of the court.
Court is adjourned until further order of the court.